Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
So this week we are going to look at two major themes in the Gospels, two things that Jesus taught about in slightly challenging ways. And I want to begin by thinking really about what were the central unifying symbols of Judaism. We said in week one of this term that actually when we talk about Judaism at the time of Jesus, it's perhaps more helpful to talk about Judaisms in the sense that there are lots of different representations or different flavors of Judaism according to people's theological leanings or particular passions or that sort of thing. Hi. That said, there we go, have some notes. That said, there are certain things that all Jewish groups held as key central symbols for them. Even if they interpreted them differently, these were the things that held them together. And in particular, they are things that marked out Judaism from the other nations. And so the idea was that if you were to look at the people who were embodying these particular symbols, it would be clear that these were God's people as opposed to all the other nations. And these central sort of unifying symbols are the things that we're going to look at over this week and next week. And they are four incredibly big themes, and so we're not going to be able to tackle them all in huge amounts of depth, but hopefully get you thinking a little bit about what Jesus had to say about them, ways in which he reaffirmed them, ways in which he challenged them, perhaps ways in which he said, actually, that symbol is now obsolete, or you've been thinking about it in the wrong way, or ways in which he expanded them. And in week one, I raised the question of continuity and discontinuity and said sometimes it's a challenge when we think about the New Testament to think how much continuity is there between the Old Testament and New, how much discontinuity is there. And I think we'll get into some of those difficult tensions when we look at these symbols, because in some cases it seems like Jesus is saying there's huge discontinuity here, you've got it entirely wrong and there's a new way. At other times he seems to affirm some of these old symbols and help us to see them in new ways. So we're going to look at these symbols, starting with the first two today. And I just want to sketch out very briefly what the four are. And if you turn to the first sort of main page on your notes, you will see that I have argued, and this is based on what other people have said, so it's not just my theory really, but there are four major central unifying symbols in Judaism. They are monotheism, election, temple, and Torah. And those are the four that we're going to look at over the next 2 weeks. So just to spell out what they are, monotheism, I won't say too much about that because that's what I'm going to teach on for the next half hour or so, but monotheism has to do with who God is and what he is like. Election is more to do with who are God's people, who are the ones he has chosen as his own. Temple is, well, it's fairly obvious what the temple is in the sense that it was a structure, but what it represented, it was a place where you'd find forgiveness, where you would meet with God. And then Torah, the law, is sort of about how you live, really. So in essence, the four symbols, monotheism, election, temple, and Torah, basically sum up this series of questions. Who is God? Who are his people? Where can we meet him? And how does he want us to live? And those were essentially the four big questions that held Judaism together and marked it out from all other nations. And we're going to sort of tease out what some of these mean and then what they meant to Jesus. But just to say, they're not clearly delineated categories. There's a lot of crossover between them. So when we think about temple, we can't think about temple without thinking about the land. And the same goes for covenant and election. And all these things interweave in many ways. But today, essentially, we're going to look at monotheism and election. Who is God and who are his people? And I'm going to start off by looking at monotheism for a little bit. And then Andy Tuck is going to come and talk to us a bit about election. Who are the people of God according to the Old Testament and the New Testament, particularly in the teachings of Jesus? But let's start with monotheism. And there's a prayer in Deuteronomy which is essentially, I think, one of the, if not the most foundational prayers of the Jewish faith. And it's one that people would recite on a daily basis. It was so core that in essence it summed up much of what Jews believed about their God and about their relationship to him. And the prayer is known as the Shema. It is in Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. It says this: "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And this is really a fundamental prayer that undergirds the Jewish view of monotheism. Now, if I were to ask you what is what is monotheism? What kind of things come to mind when you hear that word? One God. Yeah. Great. Well, that's it really, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's essentially what we think of. Monotheism. There is one God. Mono, one. Theism to do with God. So there's one God, as opposed to two gods, three gods, seven gods, 642 gods. And of course, in the Old Testament, and everything in between. And of course, in the Old Testament, very often these letters and these stories were written in a context of polytheism, the belief in many gods. And there are many different cultures that Israel came up against where they would worship many, many, many gods. And often it will be the case that if one nation defeated a god or defeated another nation, rather, they would adopt their gods into their pantheon, their group of gods, and so their group of gods would continue growing and growing and growing. And so it was quite countercultural, I think, for the Jewish people to believe and to pray that there is one God. That was quite rare at that time. Not many other people were saying there is only one God. But actually, I think when we come to the question of monotheism, it's easy for us just to think of it in fairly narrow terms. It's all numerical. It's about there being one God as opposed to many gods. And that's definitely there. That's a core part of what monotheism meant. But actually, I think monotheism in this prayer and the Shema has more to do not just with numerical simplicity, there being one God, but actually to do with unity and supremacy. Unity and supremacy. And when we say there is one God, we don't simply mean if you were to count them all up, you'd stop at one. Although we do mean that. We mean, and this God is unified and supreme. So it's a polemic idea. And people would often think about the monotheistic religion, the idea of there being one God, in three categories. And these are, as I've spelled out in the notes, creational monotheism, ethical monotheism, and covenantal monotheism. Let me explain what those mean. Creational monotheism. Tied up in the idea that there is one God, is also the idea that this one God is the creator of everything. One God has made everything. And therefore, all other gods are, by extension, created things. And this is important for Israel and for many of their original hearers, because many of the nations worshipped things that they considered gods. And by saying there is only one God who is the creator of all things, it meant that inherent in the Jewish understanding is that those other things you worship are not gods, they are created things. They are idols, the term is in the Old Testament. So creational monotheism says that there is one God who created everything else, and if you are worshipping anything else, you are not worshipping the Creator, you are worshipping created things. And if you look through the Old Testament, you find there are all sorts of passages that seem to be skewering this sort of polytheistic idea of the world by saying our Creator God created the things that you worship as if they were creators. And we could look at a few examples of those. Genesis would be one, I think, when the Genesis writer is writing the accounts of creation. I don't think he's particularly saying, let me tell you exactly how God created the world and how long it took him. I think he's saying there is one creator God who created them, and all other attempts to explain creation fall flat because there is one creator, and you are worshipping created things. So when it makes throwaway comments about the sun and the moon and the stars, you've got to remember that at that time, many people worshipped the sun and the moon and the stars. And so by saying in just a throwaway line, oh, and he made the stars also, and he's saying, oh yeah, and that God, by the way, our God made that God. And so it's a way of saying, monotheism is a way of saying, I believe there is one God and everything else is a created thing. And we could look at, well, I won't do this because this will ruin Dave Strauss' talk in 2 weeks' time, but in the Exodus story, we started a series on Exodus today, similar things going on there with the plagues, which each one seems to be a particular attack upon one of the many gods that Egypt believed in. So they had a ram god, and they had a god of the sun, and a god of et cetera, et cetera. Each plague seems to be a way of saying, nope, our God created all these things and has power over them, but I won't say any more on that because otherwise Dave will be angry with me when he comes to preach in 2 weeks' time. But all throughout the Bible, we see this sense. One creator God, everything else is a created thing. That's creational monotheism. Secondly, ethical monotheism. And the idea here is that this one God is the judge and the benchmark for what is good, what is ethical. It's not simply that he says, I set these laws, or that the laws exist apart from him, but rather he is the benchmark. He is the good God. So when he is described as being love, it's not like he there is this external measure of love that he happens to measure up to. No, he is the embodiment of love. He is the embodiment of goodness. And so all ethics are measured against this one creator God. And so when people would see whether natural disasters or victory and loss in war or things like that, when they would see them as activity of God, it would be like saying, I recognize that this one God has the right to be able to say what is right and what is wrong and to be able to judge accordingly. So in the Jewish worldview, ethical monotheism says we rely on him for the benchmark of our ethics and we recognize that he alone is able to judge. So when you come across conflicting ethical worldviews, you say, no, we disregard that because our God, who is alone able to judge, he says X. And so that was the measure for morality. Thirdly, and this is all quite abstract, but we'll come and we'll ground this in just a moment. Thirdly, covenantal monotheism. And I won't say too much about this because Andy will in a minute. But the idea behind covenantal monotheism is that there is one God who is able to make promises with mankind, and he chooses particular people to enter into covenant or promise relationships with. So when we think about covenantal monotheism, we're thinking about the fact that this one God has chosen one people for himself so that they'll be bound together by promise. And so when people are praying the Shema every day and they're seeing, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," they're not simply saying, "There's only one of you." They're saying, "There is only one of you, and therefore I will not give myself to worshipping idols as created things. There is only one of you, and you are the benchmark for morality, so I want my entire life to be guided by you. There is only one of you, and I believe I am part of your chosen people, and I want to live like that." So it's quite a rich prayer to be praying. It's not simply numerical. It's more about unity and supremacy. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay. Obviously that is quite an abstract idea and an abstract sketch of quite a big and difficult theme. There's plenty more we could say on that. But if you turn over to the next page, what I want to look at is this. If that is the understanding of monotheism, then we've got to ask, what did Jesus think about that? Did he affirm it? Did he enlarge it? Did he challenge it in any particular ways? Now, one particular idea that I want to pick up on, and we'll do a little bit of group work to unpack this, is the idea that God himself is involved in history and is coming to meet with his people. We talked 2 weeks ago about the kingdom being a main theme in Scripture, and it is all the way through, the rule of God, the ever-increasing rule of God. But tied up in this is also the idea that the king himself would come and meet with his people in his land. And so if you look through the prophets, they don't simply promise that the kingdom is coming. They also say that the king is coming. And we're going to look at a few Old Testament passages that talk about the return of Yahweh, the return of God to Jerusalem. And we're going to unpack a few of the expectations that people would have had about what this would be like. So what I'm going to do is just break you down into four groups in a second and give you each a set of three verses. And I'd like you to read these verses and think to yourself, what were the people longing for with the return of God to his land? What were they expecting it to be like? What were they prophesying it to be like? And how did Jesus embody or fulfill those expectations? Now, for some of us, this will be easier than others, depending on how much you're familiar with the language of the Gospels. But some of these passages you'll read and you'll think, actually, that sounds a little bit like something Jesus said, or a little bit something Jesus did. And I want you to identify those things. Some of it you'll look at and you think, no idea at all. Never come across that. That's totally fine. And we'll unpack it together. But answer this question. What did people expect to happen when Yahweh returned to Zion? And how did Jesus embody those expectations? So let me just break you into a couple of groups. And then we will take sort of probably 5 minutes or so. Let me have a look. Okay, let's feedback a little bit from the different groups, and we will start with group one. I'm aware that actually, these guys get it easy, because Isaiah is easy to find, and you guys probably spent most of your time trying to find Zechariah, so sorry about that. But let's start with this group. Any particular themes that came through in the three passages you looked at, and what would they tell us about what people expected and how did Jesus embody those expectations?
Elizabeth is our spokesman.
Great. Go, Elizabeth.
Not exactly willingly. It was quite confusing sometimes because a lot of the language is very different.
Sure.
But we had ideas about Jesus cleansing Israel and there being holy people left in Jerusalem, God's judgment, Jesus' presence by the pillar of cloud and the pillar of smoke, and leadership of his people.
Yeah.
And later we had God reigning in Jerusalem, salvation coming through that, and that it was quite geographically specific, so it was very much on Mount Zion, and it wasn't on any of the other people, it was definitely the Jews and not anybody else.
Okay. Great. So when Yahweh returns, he returns to his holy mountain, and there are a lot of references to the holy mountain, and he brings cleansing and ruling and leadership and his presence. And I don't know exactly what people would have thought about the presence of God looking like, but when you think about how Jesus embodied that, I mean, he literally embodied the presence of God. He literally stood on the holy mountain, and in quite a striking and very physical way, he embodied what people might have thought about in strangely sort of, metaphorical is not quite the word, spiritual terms, I suppose. He literally stood on the holy mountain. You made a point there about cleansing Israel, and I think that's a key thing that comes through Jesus' ministry. Actually, he seems to focus on Israel, the people of Israel, for a large part of his ministry. In fact, he tells his disciples, don't go amongst the Gentiles for a season. He's really focusing on Israel. Why? Because he wants to bring cleansing to God's holy people who have become corrupted or sullied in many different ways. Great. Did you have anything else? Sorry, I might have cut you off short. Or...
just that some of it looked like Jesus and some of it kind of wasn't that recognisable in terms of the people at the time Jesus was around wouldn't have seen that he was bringing salvation because he didn't do that until...
Sure, so, yes.
And lots of things where, yes, he is a presence, but he's not God's presence in the way that you would think that he looked like it came.
Yes.
He'd go around with all the... You know, he just kind of wandered around. And
yes.
Like he didn't...
Yeah, brilliant. So two things there that are particularly interesting. One is you only know with hindsight how Jesus fulfills some of these things. So at the time, people would have been hearing him and not knowing how he was going to bring salvation because they were at the early side of the cross, I suppose. And now with hindsight, we can look back and see how Jesus did fulfill certain things. But also the sense that God is in their midst and they wouldn't recognize him because that people weren't expecting God to literally take on flesh and walk amongst them, and especially not to do so with dusty feet, as you put it. And this idea of a carpenter rather than a king, which is quite a lot of the shock, isn't it, of why people, when Jesus started teaching parables like the wicked tenants, like we looked at last week, people are outraged by it. When he came into Jerusalem on a donkey, rather than leading a war, the zealots would have thought, what kind of joker is this? This is not the sort of person who's going to lead us to victory. So he challenged a lot of people's expectations. Yeah. And if you were to, I know you guys won't have read the passages, but just a few things that are just worth looking out for. In the Isaiah 4 bit, it talks about there being refuge and shelter from the storm and rain, which sounds sort of like what Jesus said when he talked about the wise and the foolish builders and people building their lives upon him. In Isaiah 24, he talks about the moon and the sun being ashamed. And we'll come to this next term when we look at some of what Jesus says in Mark 13 particularly. But he talks about this day, the coming of the Son of Man, and the moon and the sun being affected and turning to blood and all these sorts of things. It seems that Jesus somehow sees himself as the embodiment of these verses. Great, there's tons more we could say on that, I'm sure, but that's brilliant. Group two. I've forgotten who I assigned two to. There you go, great. So any thoughts from your passages?
So we got the themes we got out of it were salvation, healing, joy, God revealing his glory and his asserting his leadership and strong hand of his people, and there'll be there's comfort and happiness.
Great. And how did Jesus embody those?
He kind of quoted lots of these during his ministry.
Great. And why did he quote them? Sorry?
Because they were about him.
because they're about him, and because they were explaining things he was literally doing, weren't they, as well? So he's healing people and saying, you shouldn't be surprised that I'm healing people, because Isaiah 35 talks about the eyes of the blind being opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, and all these sorts of things. So, yeah, he literally was doing the healing thing that people were dreaming of, and then saying, well, of course I'm doing that, because that's what you expected when Yahweh comes to his people. So, yeah, so healing, salvation, joy are big themes there. Yeah, anything else? It's fine if not. Those are the big themes. It's just a couple of things that occur to me as you go through the passage. And again, other guys won't have seen these passages, but do look at them. He also talks about rivers of gushing water, which sound very like what Jesus was talking about in John 7, where he's talking about the giving of the Spirit that bubbles up like these streams of living water that come and give you life. There's the phrase in Isaiah 40 about in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, which seems to be pointing to John the Baptist, who is preparing for Jesus' arrival as well in the wilderness. And this idea of valleys being raised up and mountains being brought low, I think was probably not, they were not expecting some landscape gardening from the King of Kings. I think they were probably expecting this being like a metaphor of equality and openness and inclusion. And when Jesus seems to spend his time with the lowest of people and elevates them in society, and then he addresses some of the people who consider themselves the highest in society and tries to knock them down a peg or two, it's like this reordering that brings equality and openness and inclusion in his holy kingdom. So I think that's a powerful metaphor. And then in Isaiah 52, it's worth just looking at that for a second. It's just such a beautiful passage. In Isaiah 52, and starting at verse 7, it says, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news. And I said a couple of weeks ago, I think, that word good news, euangelion, means gospel. Who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. And I argued a couple of weeks ago, this is essentially the gospel in the Old Testament, the kingdom of God. So when Jesus is coming along and proclaiming, your God reigns, he's fulfilling Isaiah 52. The kingdom message is a way of saying, your God reigns, and by the way, he's here in me. I'm embodying this. And there's loads more we could say about that. Allusions to the Good Shepherd, I think, as well. But great, wonderful. Group three, Zechariah, how did you get on? Your group three, yeah? Great.
Quite complex.
No, it's actually quite simple. I think you... No, I'm kidding. It is complex. You're right. Yes.
There's a lot of talking about how Israel being funded and talking about the God who is throwing them in.
Yes.
Almost kind of a bend to that in a way.
So it sounds militaristic. It sounds like God defeating enemies.
Yeah.
And those enemies are probably nations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. That is what it sounds like. Yes. Yes. So that everyone else got that. So that's Zechariah 14 particularly, isn't it? So this idea of the mountain splitting and moving as well. It's like half of it's going to move north and half of it's going to... Yeah. Interesting. What does it say just before that? It says that the king's holy feet, his feet will stand on the Mountain of Olives, and it will split in two. Yeah. What did Jesus say? He says, you could tell a mountain, if you have enough faith, go and cast yourself into the ocean. And it seems to be that sort of thing. Jesus is, as his feet were literally standing there on the mountain, he says, you could, if you had enough faith, you could cast a mountain into the ocean. And Jesus seems to be talking about this moving of mountains, the shattering of mountains, as being somehow embodied in him. And then, of course, literally at his death, what happens? Earthquake. Yeah, earthquake. Did he say that while he was literally on the Mount of Olives? That's something I should know, but I don't off the top of my head. I'll have a look in a minute. I hesitate because I know someone, I've definitely heard someone say that before, but I couldn't say yes without actually going back for all integrity. Someone says yes. I'll check in a moment. Yeah. Great, yes. So what is Jesus called in the Gospels? Emmanuel. Why? Because it means God with us, God in our midst. And that definitely seems to be in his name. It's an embodiment of these verses, the idea that God is literally in their midst. In fact, in Luke's Gospel, this is a really strong theme. It's in Luke's Gospel, I think we're told that he is to be known as Emmanuel. And in Luke's Gospel, it's regularly emphasizes the visiting of God to his people. So Luke 1:68, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come to his people and redeemed them. Luke 7, they were filled with awe and praised God and said, a great prophet has appeared amongst us. They said, God has come to help his people in the person of Jesus. Luke 19, it talks about this judgment that will come because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. And so Luke particularly seems to emphasize this sense that Jesus, Emmanuel, is God come to us in the way that Zechariah sort of hints at.
If you guys turn over the page onto the next slide, we're looking at this issue of election. And so having looked at Jewish monotheism and how we understand sort of more of who God is, the Jewish understanding of who God is, it's kind of natural for us then to move on to think about the people of God and kind of how Jesus starts to redefine this notion to his contemporaries. To do this, we're going to delve into a few passages in the Gospels where Jesus kind of subverts common understandings, commonly held notions about what it means to be the people of God. And he also brings subtle, or as we'll see, not so subtle challenges to the people he's engaging with. To understand how he does this, though, we need to just do a little bit of thinking about the mindset of Jesus' contemporaries.
Oh, should I speak? Keep that one going.
Great. So we just need to do a bit of work into how his contemporaries were thinking and how they would have understood themselves as the people of God. Got a quote for you at the top of that page from a guy named Christopher Wright. And he says this: Israel's self-understanding as the people, as a people uniquely chosen by the God Yahweh for himself, was part of the very core of Israel's worldview and national identity. So then to understand this self-understanding, we need to understand Israel's story. And the core of that story, as Liam has alluded to earlier, were the kind of covenants that we read about throughout the Old Testament made between God and his people. A helpful way that I've just to help me think about what covenants are, think about them as like contracts or statements of commitment. In the ancient Near East, so that's the time of the Old Testament, covenants were used in all sorts of ways. There's examples of covenants being used as a basis of treaties between powers and empires, commitments between kings and their people, and even in marriages and business relationships. So these covenants are also really key to our understanding of the story of the Old Testament and of Jewish identity, particularly in the first century. Two covenants that I'd particularly like to draw our attention to help us understand this story of Israel's election, their formation as a nation, their kind of their national life together. They are the covenant that God made with Abraham in Genesis, but also the covenant that God makes with Moses and Israel in the Sinai desert following their exodus from Egypt. And let's just consider each of these in turn and pick up a few of their main features. So the first one, the Abrahamic covenant. So God's covenant with Abraham, they can be found in Genesis 12, 15, 17, and 22. There are really some remarkable passages of scripture. Let me just briefly recap the story of Genesis so far. So we've had that story of creation and fall, so of Noah and the flood and then the dispersal of nations around the world. And then we get to chapter 12 and there's this guy named Abraham sat in a place called Ur, which will be in modern day Iraq. And when we read about God coming to him and calling him out of his homeland to form a new nation, a nation set apart for God, flip with me to Genesis 12 and we'll read verses 2 and 3. So if you've got a Bible, just to Genesis 12, 2 to 3, just read there what God says to Abraham. He says this: I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. So here is God coming and declaring to childless Abraham that his descendants will form a great nation, one that will be blessed, but also a blessing to the nations. The subsequent covenants that we read of build on these promises, kind of flesh out a bit of what that would really mean for his descendants. So if you flick to Genesis 22, and particularly verses 17 and 18, let me read those to you. God says this to Abraham there, "I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies. And though you're off, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." So these passages full of grand promises that Abraham's descendants will be a strong and mighty nation, even possessing cities. They will be a blessing and be blessed. So that's the really big picture. Just a couple of, just to focus us on one specific feature that I'd just like to tease out, which is that of circumcision that we find in Genesis 17. Now, circumcision was a sign given to Abraham and his descendants of this covenant. It was an outward sign that marks the consecration of Israel. It would have been a constant reminder for Abraham's descendants and for God's people that God had chosen them and had blessed them. It would have reminded them that they, God's people, could do nothing to earn or merit inclusion within God's covenant people. It was a reminder of God's grace and God's election to Abraham's descendants. This was and is an identifier, so a real symbol of belonging. It's still a really cherished Jewish tradition. So that's briefly, very briefly, the Abrahamic covenant. Let's move on just to consider how the covenant that God makes with Moses and Israel on Sinai. So it's just after they've left Egypt. Now, we're just starting a new sermon series on Moses, so we're going to get very familiar with this story. But just to recap it for you briefly, after years of slavery in Egypt, the Israelites are miraculously released from bondage. God sends the plagues on Egypt, splits the Red Sea so his people can make their way to the Promised Land. And on their way to the Promised Land, God comes and renews his covenant with his people. And as you would expect, there's loads of continuity between this covenant and the one that we read about with Abraham. And just like that one, this covenant again marks the birth of a great nation on the way to the Promised Land with relationship with God at its heart. So if you want to flick to Exodus 19, verses 1 to 6, we'll just read that through. It's kind of the starting of God coming and bringing this covenant to his people. So Exodus 19, verses 1 to 6, and we read, "On the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day they came to the desert of Sinai. After they had set out from..." Oh, I didn't practice that word. "They entered the desert of Sinai, and Egypt camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, 'This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites.'" So these are some really massively significant verses for us. Just good for us just to dwell on some of the language that's used. We'll particularly focus on verses 5 and 6. Here God is really reinforcing Israel's uniqueness. "So out of all the nations," he says, "you will be my treasured possession." Worth noting that God does say that Israel isn't his sole possession, his only possession. We need to remember that Israel's role within the divine plan is one that will involve every nation. But there is a distinction here between Jews and Gentiles, that is, Jews and everyone else. God is setting for himself apart a people for himself to be his own treasured possession. And so while there are notable exceptions to this within the Old Testament, so think of characters like Rahab and Ruth, this promise seems to be for the Jews themselves. And you see the role that they are to have. So in verse 6 we read that God declares that Israel are to be a nation of priests, a holy nation, set apart and consecrated for God's own use. So this we see then the purpose of God's people, the purpose of their election. And then following on from these verses in those next few chapters, God goes on to give his people the law. And while we'll cover much of this next week when we look at the Torah, I mention it now to draw your attention to the vocational nature of Israel's relationship with God. For Israel's response to God's election was obedience to the law. Now, we should be clear that obedience to the law here should not be seen as the basis for becoming God's people, but rather for living as God's people. So in it, he gives his people unique practices that will set them apart from the nations around them. So think of the Sabbath or their food laws, which prevent the Jews from sharing food with the Gentiles. And so this law becomes another identifier for God's people, Israel. Now, let's just reflect briefly about how this would have impacted upon the national psyche of Israel and the Israelites. What would it do to them to think, oh, we are the chosen people, we are God's elected ones? To do this, let's just quickly reflect on the book of Hosea. Now, Hosea is one of the minor prophets, and you can find it just after the book of Daniel if you're wanting to find it. And I think it expresses something of the intimacy that would have been used to describe Israel's relationship with Yahweh. So Hosea is a prophet who was instructed by God to marry a prostitute. He is to take her into his home and to love her dearly as his wife. But Gomer, the prostitute, is unfaithful repeatedly. And it is out of this personal pain that Hosea is instructed to prophesy to Israel that they are like his adulterous wife and they are not being faithful to God. Now, marriage is incredibly tender language to express a relationship. For the Israelites to consider themselves to be married for God is huge. It implies an intimacy of relationship, a commitment that they had to one another. And this illustration, this metaphor of marriage is right throughout the whole book. There's another metaphor as well that we read about in Hosea. So Hosea 11, 3 and 4, which are on your handouts. Let me just read those to you. So God saying to Israel through Hosea, "It was I who taught Ephraim to walk." Ephraim is a word there for Israel. "It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by their arms. They did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them." What incredibly intimate language to use. The picture here is of a parent with their child. God is taking Israel by the hands and teaching them to walk, bending down to feed them. Incredible images. A treasured possession indeed. And so can you see how Abraham's descendants would have such a strong national identity as a nation set apart for God? Now, we're just going to do some exercises now, just to look at some passages, to look at how Jesus understood and what he taught about being the people of God. Now, as we've seen in previous weeks and already mentioned today, when Jesus teaches, there's both a sense of continuity and discontinuity with the Old Testament. So basically, we're going to explore how Jesus taught on the subject of who are the people of God. Now, we have four passages to look at. So in a second, I'll split us into four groups. In fact, we'll use the four groups that we did before. Just spend a bit of time reading through the passage you're given and really consider how that story in it, like how they challenge the notions of what it means to be the people of God. Look out for things that might be surprising or shocking. Look out for that continuity and discontinuity. And we've got about 10 minutes or so for this. So if you do finish your passage, do feel free to move on to other ones and contribute in with that discussion. But yeah, why don't we break into those groups that we were in, those four groups, and have a go of the exercises. They're just on the back of the handout, so have a go at those.
I have your attention again, please. We'll just feedback from the groups. So group one, if you wouldn't mind, if we come to you first. Just because I imagine you haven't had a chance to familiarise yourselves with all of the verses, all of the passages. So if you guys wouldn't mind just briefly summarising the verses that you've looked at and then just feedback what you thought.
Baptist is baptizing people in the wilderness, and few % made of Abrahamic, as big a deal as perhaps it also was, that even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees, so actually you can be cut out of the tree of Jesse if you're not repentant, if you're not bearing fruit, that actually just being Jewish isn't really enough. There's that Jesus is coming to baptise with the Holy Spirit and with fire, so actually that's a new thing, that people weren't baptised by the Holy Spirit before. And a split between the wheat and the chaff. So he talks about Jesus gathering the wheat into the barn and throwing the chaff into the fire. So that's a split between, I think, the repentant and the unrepentant, rather than necessarily being between Jews and Gentiles.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a real crucial point in the gospel story. So it's coming right at the start. You kind of get this real shift that from sort of the old covenant to just kind of pointing forward a bit towards Jesus and this new covenant and the new thing that he's coming to do amongst. Really challenging and provocative words. So, yeah, right to pick up on the God's able to raise up from these stones even children of Abraham. Really provocative to people who are like, hey, I'm a child of Abraham. This is who I am. This is my core identity. And rather, John the Baptist, you're right as well, pointing them towards the, you need to bear the fruit of repentance. This is about a life of faith that you're living. It's not, you know, you can't just be, you don't just think you're in just because you're from Abraham, which is great. Really challenging stuff, really provocative to people in this day. Group two. Is that you guys, right? Tell us a bit about the story, the verse that you read out, and then some of your thoughts from it. Yeah, great. Yeah, great. Did you like pick up any particularly shocking phrases or imagery that Jesus might have used in these verses? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is harsh. Yeah. Yeah. There is some really distinctive language, I suppose, he uses for those that are going to be. Yeah, sort of in and the those that are out. I think, yeah, you're right to identify the really shocking element of this, I suppose, is Jesus coming and saying, it's that phrase, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. It's almost like Jesus is saying, look, those that you would expect to have faith in me as their coming Messiah don't have faith. And those that you would expect to doubt or, you know, be on the kind of outside, hey, this is a guy that I've seen no greater faith in all of Israel, in all of my ministry that I've been around. Wow, look at this guy. As Liam alluded to earlier, the kind of the big phrase here is that many will come from the east and the west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. So to recline at a table is to come and eat. Kind of Jesus is here pointing towards those big metaphors of the, you know, the banquet at the end of time, you know, the coming together of God's people. And he seems to be saying here that God's people won't be complete unless kind of people come from sort of the east and the west, unless it's people like the centurion that come and join us. The really shocking thing here, though, is whose table is he saying that they come and eat at? But Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. So you remember the food laws, kind of some of the culture that the Jews would have had around that time of, actually, we can't share food with the Gentiles. They're going to eat things that are unclean to us. Jesus is here saying, hey, these guys will become and welcomed to my table. They will be welcomed to the table. You think you're Jewish? They will come to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the kind of the daddies of the faith, right? The great patriarchs. They're going to come and eat at his table. Like really incendiary stuff, you know, that he's communicating. I love it. It kind of speaks about Jesus' open table policy a bit, you know, kind of the way that he kind of invites anyone. Yeah, it's very good. Great. Anything else that you guys think about that for? Wonderful. All right, let's go to group three, and we shift Gospels from Matthew into Mark. So this is a passage, Mark 3. So group three, would you mind just telling us a bit about your passage? What's it about? Shocking elements.
In that show, it's just Jesus actually choosing the 12 disciples.
Yeah.
Once choosing the 12 disciples, giving them authority to cast that spirit on demons. I think what we actually picked up was it was Jesus that actually chose the disciples from various backgrounds, probably the very most unlikely people to be disciples.
Mm. Tell us about the family's reaction to this. What do they do?
They were furious.
Yeah.
Probably either the probably a huge crowd to the family.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's the last kind of sentence of this passage. So Jesus chooses the 12 disciples, and then it says, and when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he is out of his mind. So he picks the 12, and there seems to be this huge reaction to it. So if Jesus is redefining sort of the people of God, talking about that, if that's what we're thinking about, can you think of the significance of 12, the number 12 in this? Like, where else would we read that in the... Yeah, exactly. So here's Jesus sort of like reconstituting a people of Israel, like getting a new... These are the 12 that are coming. So this may be lost on us slightly because, you know, this kind of... It's a bit more abstract for us. But you imagine, like, if I was had, you know, 22 mates together, drew them into two groups of 11. The significance there is that you'd go, oh, we're about to play a game of football. You know, we've divided the teams up. So when Jesus is here drawing 12 people to himself, can you see how people would be like, what are you doing? Like, his family see it. They're kind of like, you're kind of drawing a new people together, aren't you? Like, they sort of sense the gravity of that situation. No wonder they went, mate, you're out of your mind. you're making a massive grand statement here. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. So they kind of twig something of that, wow, this is a huge statement, drawing together of a new people. Yeah. Do you get that? It's a remarkable thing, isn't it? Because in one way you just go, oh, this is Jesus picking his mates. These are the guys going to be following him around. Yet even in this simple action seem to hold really like prophetic significance of Jesus' action in the world. Great. Yeah, I think that's all that I got from that as well. Great. Should we do Mark 7? So this is group 4, last one. Tell us about the passage.
It's about a lady who's a Gentile who goes up to Jesus and asks him to heal her daughter who's possessed by a demon. And he says, let the children eat the bread on the table and not the dogs. And then she says, but there's some scraps that fall on, like, can we eat those? And then he's like, okay, your faith is impressed with her faith and her daughter's healed.
Yeah. It's a great verse to get into, great verses. So how does Jesus really challenge sort of notions of what it means to be the people of God through this story?
So we kind of think he kind of does and also he kind of doesn't.
Okay.
So he kind of accepts the premise that, or he kind of suggests the premise that this food just for the Israelites almost, this is just on the table, these have got special people who get the healing, that's why he came. And at that point, it's like, you know, I'm not going to heal this woman because she's not in the chosen people, perhaps. And it's only when she comes back and says, yes, I want, you know, but surely some of the crumbs fall down, And even then, he kind of, we're almost thinking, maybe he'll say, oh no, well, you know, we're all one people now. There's no neither Jew nor Gentile. We're all one people, so I'll heal you. It's like, kind of accept, yes, you are a dog, and yes, I'll let you have a scrap. But yeah, he does give it to her. And then we were discussing, is that just a bit of healing for her daughter? Or is that she's accepted into the full promises of the kingdom? It was an interesting discussion.
Out of all the passages when I was going through, I found this one the hardest because it's got some of the most provocative language in it, in terms of just like, Jesus, you just called someone a dog, like, come on. So I suppose helpful to think, so dogs here would kind of, is synonymous with Gentiles. So derogatory, yes, but they kind of would have picked up on, a non-Jewish person. So kind of Jesus talking about that. There's a similar theme if you picked it up from with the centurion of the, this is someone outside the people of God, but is demonstrating more faith. Jesus' comment here, it does sound really harsh because he said, let the children be fed first. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Actually, rather than that being like a dismissive thing, I wonder whether we should read that almost like Jesus trying to tease out a bit of faith from this woman. So kind of, oh, you've got a seed of it. You kind of know what it is. Just, you know, let me, what does that mean? Sort of bring it out. So rather than it being just Jesus dismissing, I wonder whether we can see an encouragement edge to this as well. Like, go on, you know, work this through. Okay, so I've come for the Jewish people, but, you know, what's going on there? So it's almost like at the end he goes, yes, like you've got it. For this statement, you know, the demon has left his daughter. Yes, I see the faith in you and what you've recognised. Hard verses, but still, yeah. Is that helpful? Is there anything else that you guys want to draw out from these verses?
I think one of the things that it's not in here, but in terms of how here Jesus referred to say it's not good to give children to the dogs, but kind of tying on that, it's not the first time he's actually kind of pointing out when I think there's a part where he says, you know, come to the lost sheep of the house of David. So where he kind of, you know, nations always come after when other people came to say, oh, well, can you do this, can you do that? He kind of saves that.
Yes.
And later on, you kind of say that, okay, you might continue healing with disciples, but he kind of still points out, look, I'm coming for this.
Yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? It's this tension we hold when we read sort of about Jesus' ministry, that there's this shift that's kind of like Jesus coming to expand everyone's vision. And kind of with hindsight, we see the result of that is kind of the birth of the church, the Holy Spirit being given, the gospel being wanting to spread not only to Jerusalem and Judea, but also to Samaria and the ends of the earth. You know, this great banquet that he keeps talking about. Hey, people are going to, you know, enter into the people of God. So it's really hard, isn't it, to hold on to these two tensions. Jesus is very much in a Jewish world, very much in that sort of within that worldview, and he's articulating this expanding gospel, this expanding kingdom to them. Yeah, worthwhile doing some study. Sorry, let me very quickly just give you one concluding thought, and then we'll just have some time for questions. If you flip back to the other page, you'll see that I put some verses from 1 Peter 2, verses 9 and 10 in there. Partly just to help us think through, okay, so we're looking at the Gospels, but like I say, we can look on all these things with hindsight as well. And in the New Testament, the people of God is like a massive theme that those the New Testament writers pick on and pick up. So for us as Gentiles reading this, we should realize the amazing implications of Jesus' teaching for us, that we actually can count, you know, ourselves as these people of God. So the New Testament really emphatic about this. These are the words of Peter to churches that would have been in sort of Galatia, Pontus is kind of modern day Turkey, that sort of area, so Gentile churches, when he says this, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, and now you have received mercy. Can you hear in those verses sort of the chimes of Exodus 19? You know, I'm going to commission a holy nation. We can see in these verses the fulfillment of sort of Genesis 12, that the nations are blessed as we come to God through Jesus, the seed of Abraham. Is it the wonderful truth in these verses that we too can come because of Jesus to be declared the people of God, a community built around the person of Jesus? So that's kind of me done. why don't we just have maybe a couple of minutes of questions? Liam might take us through the bits we missed off as well. Would you like to do questions? Or?
Any questions? I've just got one thought that may tie these things together. But look,
sorry.
Any questions from you guys?
I'll get that.
Yeah, it's fine.
Thanks, sir.
Jeffrey. Great. The question is, what about all the bloodshed in the Old Testament? This one's for Andy Tuck.
Great, I can do it. I can if you like.
In 30 seconds?
Ish.
Wow. Here it goes.
No. So one of the things that I find really helpful to do is just to think in why God's bringing judgment on these people. There are different... lots of different instances that are worth picking up, but very generally, when it talks about cities, some like these aren't just, you know, sort of like an innocent population of people. Often these are military outposts, which is, you know, God is talking about bringing down military infrastructure within them. But also as well, sometimes these are right judgments on people as well. So some of these societies were practicing child sacrifice and things like that. So again, it's not just people going about, you know, sort of like, oh, I'm completely ignorant and I'm just being slaughtered. It talks about God being patient with these people for 400 years and then judgment coming on. That's not a complete answer, but just things that I find helpful to think about. This isn't Jesus just going and saying, hey, go kill innocent babies. Does that help?
That does help. Okay, so Andy's exactly right. There's a talk that I did a couple of years ago called Is God a Moral Monster? Where I took about 35 to 40 minutes on this. And arguably, Andy's just done it in far quicker than I did, so I don't know why I wasted so much time. But that one may help. Here's one illustration that may help. Lord of the Rings. Sorry, I'm going Tilsley on you. But yes. Think of the story of Lord of the Rings. Yes. In Lord of the Rings, you have this ring that has to get from one place to... the other. The idea is you take the ring to Mordor, then it gets destroyed, then the whole world gets made right again, yeah? So everything is about protecting the ring and making sure it gets... from, not this ring, clearly. but the point is, you've got to get the ring to Mordor. And so what do? They get a group of people around to protect the ring bearer, protect the ring until it can get to Mordor so that the whole world can be free from this curse. So for the whole story from that point to there, the point is protect the ring, because through this ring getting thrown into the fire, all of the world gets set free. And so, of course, people do things that in normal life they wouldn't usually want to do in order to protect the ring. And I think the similar sort of thing is true of Israel. The point is that this creator God, this covenant-making God, has chosen this one people to be the blessing through which the whole world will get set free from the curse of bondage of sin. And so, of course, he is going to want to protect the ring, his Israel, until we can get to the point where freedom is released for the whole earth. And so there are things that are done there in order to protect the ring that means that others have to be defeated and that sort of thing. So that's part of the picture. The point... if the story is that God has chosen one people to be a blessing to the nations, and arguably people have forgotten that bit. And in Abraham, which Andy talked about, the promise was, I will bless you so that the nations will be blessed through you. And arguably people have been like, yes, bless us, but we don't want anything to do with the nations. And that's part of what Jesus is trying to correct here, is the idea that no, you are meant to be a blessing to the nations. And so I think God is protecting the ring, the one through whom all the nations will be blessed, so that all the nations get to benefit from it in the long run. Again, that's only a partial answer, but do check out the talk, and that may help you on that. Let me just tie together this monotheism and election thing, and kind of coming back to your question, Graham, about isn't covenantal monotheism more about the people than it is about God? Here's what I would say. When we think about the person of God, this God who is one, We think that he is one creator, one good, loving God, the benchmark of ethics and all that is good. And he has chosen a people. And that tells us something very important about who God is. He is a relational God. He is a God who chooses relationship with people. And as your group picked out, he chose the wrong people. He chose the people you would never think to choose. And he made them something beautiful and precious, through whom all the world will be blessed. And so actually, when we think about God choosing, it doesn't just tell us about people, it tells us about God. God is a God who can turn around people who are nothing into something. Hence, he can take stones and turn them into sons. He's done that with Israel and the seed of Abraham. He can do it with anyone. And so it tells us something very powerful about God, that he values relationship, and he has the power to bring out of relationship a people who will be able to transform the world, to experience more of that blessing and love that comes when the king is in charge. So when Jesus comes back and he says, I am the embodiment of Yahweh returning to Israel, and he starts to select a people for himself that are based not on their lineage or whether they've been circumcised or whatever, but by their response in faith to him, we get the monotheism and the election coming together in a new and exciting kind of way. And I suspect that in this room, almost all of us would be Gentiles. I'm not sure if we have any people here ethnically Jewish by birth. No. So all of us benefit from the coming of Jesus and him saying, yes, I came first of all to seek out the lost sheep of Israel and to bring cleansing, which is what your prophecies looked at, bring cleansing to Israel first of all. So Jesus, for his ministry, he focused on the lost sheep of Israel. That's why when someone came who was a Gentile dog, in the sort of vernacular sense, he'd say, actually, my mission first of all is to you. But if you've got Abraham's covenant, you just know that blessing can't stay contained with one people. It just bursts out so that everyone gets blessed through the people who are meant to be the blessing. So even though Jesus is focusing on the sheep and ignoring the dogs, to put it like that, even the dogs get blessed, because when it's done right, people get blessed in order to bless others as well. So Jesus' mission was focused on them, but knowing this is going far wider. This is going to the Gentiles, this is going to the whole world. And when a lady comes along and she begs for a bit, or where a centurion comes along and begs for healing, Jesus is like, this is always going to go to you anyway. Let's just give you a snippet of that healing now ahead of time, because you've responded in so much faith. Does that sort of make sense? Great. I think we've covered a lot of ground today and a lot of big things, and we've really skimmed the surface of the character of God, which is obviously a huge subject. But next week we're going to look at temple and Torah. So where do we meet God, and how does he intend for us to live? Again, two more huge subjects. But if you do have any questions, Andy Tuck will probably be able to answer some of them. We'll be around a bit at the end. But otherwise, we're done for today. See you again next week.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.